I'm Juliana Grassi, your host of the Rare Disease Report podcast. In the U.S., a rare disease is classified as having fewer than 200,000 documented cases per year. Less than 10% of them have an FDA-approved treatment. This month's episode is considered rare even for a podcast titled The Rare Disease Report. We'll be discussing a condition that has only been documented in 70 cases worldwide. This year, a new patient was diagnosed, and while she is too young to share her story, her parents have joined us, along with her doctor, who solved the mystery of her diagnosis. Dr. Amel Shillington is a clinical geneticist at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, where Ashley and Jacob Wiley have been taking their three-year-old daughter, Adelaide, for treatment of her Kawasaki disease, a rare condition causing inflammation of the blood vessels, and one we might discuss another day. Today, we're going to talk about Aisling, who's not even 2 years old and is now their second child diagnosed with a rare disease. Tango 2-related metabolic encephalopathy and arrhythmias is a rare genetic disorder caused by variants in the Tango 2 gene, and those with it can experience episodes of acute illness called metabolic crises. There's not much known about this gene variation because of how few cases have been presented, but in this episode, Dr. Shillington shares her journey to diagnosis, and Aisling's parents, Ashley and Jacob, share their story leading up to that diagnosis. Thank you, everyone, so much for being here with me today. Ashley, I first want to ask you, how is Aisling doing? And if you can share a little bit about her story.
She's doing pretty well right now. We're kind of adjusting to a new normal. We're getting to learn what her new baseline is. We are hopeful that she makes improvements each day. She is starting to move her head a little bit more. She's starting to kind of track you when you're getting close to her. Nothing huge, but any like little thing she does is it's a pretty big improvement to us. It's just nice to see that she is, you know, her body is starting to heal from the brain damage that she did get while she had her first crisis.
Can you explain a little bit about what happened? You don't have to go into too much detail if you don't want to, but
we're an open book. We're happy to share whatever, because it may help other parents in the future with, you know, if their kid has a similar situation. I don't know, maybe you might want to kind of quickly explain, because my husband is the one that found her. I was actually at the hospital with our other daughter.
So yeah, it was, I can't remember, what was the date, January?
January 9th.
Yeah, January 9th. Our oldest daughter was in the hospital, come to find out she had Kawasaki's disease. And me and my wife were going to switch off at the hospital. That way she can come home and, you know, have a couple of days, you know, to relax a little bit and be home and not in the hospital. And, you know, it was, you know, standard Saturday morning, you know, woke up. Aislinn was up. She was standing up in her crib. I brought her out to the kitchen and went to make her breakfast. As I finished up her egg, she ended up throwing up a little bit on herself. So I got her out of her high chair and I went to change her outfit, change her diaper. And then as I was doing that, she seemed very tired.
I don't want to interrupt, but we also had just gotten back from Disney like a week before that. So she was still kind of getting used to being back on her schedule at home.
Yeah.
And until this incident, there was nothing especially, you know, wrong with her that you were aware of, or
no,
other than, I know we have talked about it. So her walking was, I mean, I don't really know if it's even right to say it was delayed, because I mean, she was only
14 months old,
and you know, yes, they typically see most kids by 12 months, but it's not unusual for kids to go, you know, 18 months before they start walking. So
And she would walk around like the couch. Like it's not like she couldn't put any weight on her legs or anything. She would walk around the couch or her ottoman. She wouldn't necessarily stand up completely unassisted or walk unassisted, but again, she was only 14 months old. We were going to bring that up at her 15-month checkup. Unfortunately, we just didn't make it to that appointment because she was hospitalized before that appointment.
Yeah. And then, so I laid her down for a nap. And, you know, while I laid her down, I started cleaning the house and, you know, getting everything ready to switch off at the hospital. And, you know, she typically took about 2.5 hour long naps. And, it was at 3 hours when I was like, you know, we really need to get going, you know? So I went in there to go check on her. And, when I went in there, I turned her light on and her sound machine off that has her white noise playing. And she didn't wake up, which that was kind of the first like minor sign. Cause I mean, I would say 98% of the time that wakes her up if she's not awake already. And I walked over there to her. She was breathing. I could see her chest moving. So, you know, even at that point in time, I didn't think anything was wrong because she was breathing. So I went to her closet, was getting her an outfit out. And then once I got her outfit picked out, I went over to pick her up. That's when it really first hit me that, oh crap, something might be seriously wrong right now, because she was completely limp. You know, and I mean, it's hard to say it sometimes, but yeah, I mean, the way I explained to the doctors is, if I had to imagine what it felt like to pick up my dead daughter, that's exactly what it felt like that day. And then I immediately called Ashley. We just got lucky enough that our other doctor who was in the hospital, the ER doc, just happened to come into the room. And Ashley was like, hey, I have some questions for you about our other daughter at home. The doctor proceeded to, she had me try some things to check for responsiveness. So she had me like pinch her toes and her fingers and stuff. And, you know, she didn't respond to anything.
Right.
And at that point, she said, you know, either call an ambulance or bring her here as fast as possible. So I immediately got her out of bed, put an outfit on her and rushed her to Cincinnati Children's in Liberty, because that's where our other daughter was at.
Yeah, at that point, I couldn't leave Adelaide by herself because she's a 3-year-old. You know, I was worried that she was going to rip out her IV or something. So thank goodness my mom was there and somebody was able to stay with her while I go check out Aislinn in the parking lot. And I'm not trying to say I didn't believe Jacob when she said that she was just like, you know, not really moving, not waking up. Right. For one, as a mom, you're kind of like, there's no way that there's something going on with both of my kids. We were already so stressed about Adelaide, yeah, not knowing what exactly is happening to her at this time. And I'm like, maybe Jacob's just being a little dramatic. Maybe she just needs her mom, you know? So I ran down to the emergency room parking lot and I was kind of like, you know, patting her chest and talking to her, and she wasn't really moving. And I was like, okay, that's kind of weird. When I went to go like pick her up, like out of her car seat, he even warned me. He's like, okay, now don't freak out when you pick her up. And when I picked her up, I could just tell that something was wrong. And we just took off and we ran into the emergency room.
Yeah.
Immediately a nurse came over and grabbed her and they took her to what they call the big room at the Liberty campus. And just immediately it was filled with probably 30 people, paramedics, I mean, everybody. And then they found out that the reason why she was unconscious at that time was because her blood sugar was so low. So as soon as they started her on fluids, I think it was D10 fluids.
Yeah, because I think her blood sugar was
17. Yeah, her blood sugar was 17. And for Aislinn, her normal blood sugar is anywhere from like 95 to 105. That's kind of what her blood sugar is typically at. And hers was 17 when they checked it. Yeah. So that's why
she sounds like, it sounds like at least there was a quick response. You know, obviously this terrifying incident to happen, but at least it sounds like you guys responded quickly. And then once you got there, it sounds like you had some support at least to kind of, you know, prioritize her.
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly. So they found out why she was unconscious, which was, you know, she was hypoglycemic, but they didn't know why she was hypoglycemic. So that's why she had to be transferred to the ICU downtown.
Okay. Yeah. And that's actually where I was hoping, Dr. Shillington, I was hoping you could share some insight on, you know, the more clinical aspect of this. And I know you were in charge of the team that was searching for the diagnosis as, you know, the cause Aisling was experiencing these symptoms. So what eventually led you to uncover the truth about that diagnosis?
Yeah. Good question. So, when kids come in, so we call this a metabolic crisis. You know, they come in and something is just metabolically not right. And so for Aislinn, it was originally hypoglycemia and lack of consciousness. So, you know, when kids come in around the age of one, the ICU will often consult our genetic and metabolic team to try to get to the bottom of why is the sugar so low? And there are categories of disorders of metabolic inborn errors of metabolism where kids can kind of present in this metabolic crisis with low blood sugars. But Aislinn's story didn't quite line up with some of the more common hypoglycemic conditions we see. And certainly we thought about some of those things, but her picture just didn't quite make sense because, you know, she kind of had eaten and she hadn't been, you know, some of these kids that come in with really low blood sugars is because they've been fasting for a long time. They're sick. They're sick with a virus. They've been fasting for 24 hours and then they don't have enough stores to like make their own, energy. And so there are a bunch of different categories of disorder. So we thought about that. But like I said, she didn't really fit the classic presentation of some of those classic disorders. So we needed to work fast to find out what, her diagnosis was. There's kind of two ways we kind of try to solve genetic mysteries for kids who have metabolic disorders. One is sending metabolic testing. So actually looking at how the body is breaking down fats and how the body is metabolizing glucose and looking at if there are abnormal acids in the urine and in the blood and trying to kind of figure out the metabolic pathways, which we do send testing. We did send testing for that. And it was inconclusive because she kind of was a mystery. And we also sent something called the whole exome sequence, which actually sequences all the genes, all the coding genes of the body. Now, you can make a short list of all the disorders and go for one gene at a time and start at the list and take your top diagnosis. Like maybe you've seen medical dramas where you have a differential diagnosis and you try one at a time. And that historically has often been the way we work through medicine. Now for kids that come in unconscious with a reason we can't explain and potentially could be getting worse and we don't know why, and potentially could be offered therapies that we can't wait that long. So that's one of the reasons we send something called a whole exome sequence, which sequences all the genes. And we want to know, is there a change in a gene somewhere in a metabolic condition or something else where we can effectively change therapies for the better. So she qualified for our rapid whole exome sequence testing, which comes back sequencing the whole exome in 7 days. And so we had an answer in about 7 days. Now, for other patients where it's not as emergent, typically this type of sequencing can take 3 to 6 months. So in these cases that it's an emergency, we have the ability to get information very quickly. And that was the case for her. So in about 7 days, we were able to sit down and talk to the Wileys about her new diagnosis.
And then that, so it was the Tango 2 gene,
right?
That had the abnormality. So once you kind of realized that, like was time of the essence? Like, was it a good thing that you kind of rushed that?
I think so. We were treating the symptoms. So she had low blood glucose or hypoglycemia. So we were giving her glucose and supporting her breathing and supporting her heart and doing all the things we would do anyway. But knowing the new diagnosis allowed a few changes to her management. So, one of those things was she was having seizures, which we were trying to manage. Once we knew the diagnosis we were working with, it helped us understand what was going on in the MRI, which she did have some changes in her brain. And it helped helped us understand that those were possibly and probably temporary due to her metabolic hit. It helped us choose some seizure medications that we know worked better potentially in this disorder. And there were actually two things that we didn't, that wasn't necessarily on our radar specifically. And one was hypothyroidism, which is a part of this condition. And we hadn't tested her thyroid when she came in. And when we did test it, we did see that her thyroid levels were way low. Now that wouldn't necessarily have contributed to how she came in, but it was one other thing that we could, you know, fix to get her, you know, on her way. And certainly having her low thyroid levels might have made her slow or tired, or it could have potentially contributed to like her original presentation. So that was one thing after knowing the diagnosis we could look for and we could treat, and she was treated right away. And then one of the other things that actually is a big issue for kids who have this Tango 2 diagnosis is arrhythmias of the heart. And so kids who come in, kids who have this diagnosis can have arrhythmias that can be deadly. And once we knew that this is what we were working with, we were paying very close attention to her heart, having the electrophysiology cardiologists weigh in, having those medications available right at her bedside, watching her heart very closely, because if something were to go the wrong direction, we knew what to do because we knew what medications would work specifically for this disorder. So a lot of changes were made in her medical management, but the supportive care, I think, you know, we do anyway for kids who kind of come in a metabolic crisis.
Yeah. I was wondering, you know, how the course of action changed once you figured out the diagnosis, because I know that this is obviously a very, very rare disease. And so
for sure. And I will say, the Wileys are super great advocates, by the way. And you know, the day that I sat down with them, you know, I was like, hey, this is a diagnosis. It's good news and bad news. And one of the things I shared with them was like, this is very rare. There's like 30 cases ever reported. And these are the experts who are working on it. And there is an expert team at another institution who has kind of a family support group and a research connection. And I think on day one, the Wileys like really reached out to some of the experts in the field and said, hey, this is a new diagnosis. We need to learn everything. What can we do to help our care team here at Cincinnati Children's. And I think their advocacy was like so helpful to our team, because hopefully our team listened to you guys. And I do know, I do know that I certainly, worked with, a lot of doctors from another institution who are experts, and they were giving us a lot of guidance and advice too, and a lot of reassurance, because, you know, for me, this is the first time we've ever diagnosed this here at Cincinnati Children's. We diagnose rare disease all the time. I have a lot of N of one cases, but this is the first time anyone had ever seen this here at our institution. So sometimes it's hard to give a prognosis for like, oh my gosh, like the MRI looks bad, but what does this mean in the long term? It's hard for us to say, but a lot of the experts at the outside institution that are experts in this disease were like, hey, you know, these kids recover, like you should have a lot of hope. And I think that was good for me as a physician and also for the family. So aside from like their immediate recommendations and help and guidance, it was like overall picture it was supportive to me and hopefully to you guys too.
Wow. So even though this is so rare, like you said, rarest of the rare, you guys still kind of had a plan in place, in a sense, or at least knew what to do when that came through. Cause yeah, I was wondering like how much is actually known about this disease. And like you said, in the long term, you might not have as much information, but at least you kind of know how to handle it going forward, like day by day.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So, I mean, we gather whatever we can from at the time there was 30 cases published in the literature. Since that time, and since we've connected with the experts, they have now about 70 cases, which still makes it pretty rare. Yeah. The people who have this diagnosis really want to know, learn as much as they can and to share as much as they can, because they want to help their kids. And that's what's really important. And that's what helps physicians too, because as they share what's going on with their kids and what it looks like when they decompensate and what it looks like when they get better and what therapies are working and what medications are working. Like that's all like community information that we share back with our patients here and everywhere. So being connected with the, you know, rare disease families and rare disease teams is like, you know, part part of the whole big picture for kids with rare disease, for sure.
Yeah, I was definitely going to say that. I think that, like, you know, for rare disease in particular, like, you see the advocacy and the communication and just the collaboration networks are really strong. And so in a way, you know, like, it might, what you might lack in overall information or research, there's a lot of guidance to what you do know, I think. And so that did lead me into my next question, and either of you guys can answer, but I was wondering about the initiatives that are happening for this condition, or any collaborative research or advocacy groups that, you know, are currently happening.
Yeah, I do know them, but I bet Ashley knows more.
Okay. I don't know about that. Okay, so this is what, there is a, Dr. Miyake, based out of the Texas Children's, she is behind like a big research group. So any child that has been diagnosed with Tango 2 up until this very day has submitted a research study of their child. So the Tango 2 Research Foundation, which was actually started by one of the first diagnosed kids. It was actually started by his parents, the foundation was. But the research is based out of the Baylor College of Medicine, right? And Texas Children's. Yeah. But so we basically just, we all as parents submit our child's story to this, and kind of in reference to what Dr. Shellington said, it's basically, we're just sharing our stories and it becomes these case studies. So we can try to find similarities in these kids when they do have a crisis. And every kid kind of presents differently. Some of them do have the arrhythmias. Some of them have more brain damage. It's the same diagnosis, but the symptoms are so different and so varied with each child.
Some are having motor skill development delays and, you know, muscle fatigue and is there like recession of muscles or anything like that?
Yeah, part of that is I don't know the medical term of it, but just like not being able to use their muscles, like atonia or something like that. I don't know. We don't know the big medical terms for all this stuff, but it does, they all present very differently. I do know that there's actually another Tango 2 research, group also, somewhere in Europe. I don't think it's as common as the one in Texas with Dr. Miyake, but regardless, any child that has been diagnosed has been not treated by Dr. Miyake, but has been in contact with her. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of the research comes from. And then I know some kids have actually, they've like went to Texas Children's and they've had like a skin sample and a skin biopsy and like a blood draw, and they just kind of look at it, keep it in, you know.
Yeah, because one of the big things with it is the disease is, it's very newly founded. You know, it was just discovered in 2016. So, you know, there's not a lot of research. I mean, if you Google the Tango 2 disease diagnosis, I mean, you could go through all the documents easily within a day. I mean, you know, most people, unless you're medically trained, you know, a lot of it's way above your head, but.
Right.
A lot of this stuff too is really just trying to find like the history of it and like the background of the disease and stuff. So, I mean, that to me, that just kind of says something about like how early on it still is, that like, you know, there is no treatments really. You know, yes, there are some things to help with, you know, certain portions of the conditions.
Right.
But
you're treating the symptoms.
Yeah. Not the disease. Yeah, exactly. There's still, I mean, there is. So, I mean, they've barely scratched the surface of the disease so far with research.
Right. And actually, Dr. Shellington, because, you know, as you two were saying, there's not a lot of research and stuff. So how did you know how to react when you got the diagnosis, when you figured out that it was this gene? Like, is it related to other conditions that you've dealt with before?
Yeah, kind of. But it's also, it's an interesting one. So we actually, including the team at Texas Children's, don't exactly even know the mechanism. We think it's probably something to do with mitochondria. And if you remember from high school biology, the mitochondria are the power of the cell. And so there's something awry when people are missing the Tango 2 gene, because the Tango 2 is responsible for kind of optimizing how the mitochondria gets energy. And so if there is a time where we're deprived of energy, so for example, if kids get very ill with a virus and they need extra energy on board, if they, you know, are fasting, so they haven't eaten for like 24 hours or something like that, then the body needs more energy and the mitochondria aren't optimized and they can't get enough energy. And then that's where kids crash. And so there are other mitochondrial disorders and there are other kind of inborn errors in metabolism of fatty acid oxidation. That's another category of disorders. And so those look kind of similar where kids come, they're metabolically down. We give them sugar or glucose because that's the easiest way for the body to metabolize energy until they're able to kind of get back back those energy levels. And so we treat this as kind of a primary or secondary mitochondrial disorder in some ways. And that is what we did when we saw her. And that was kind of our working diagnosis. I think my very first note that I wrote before when I saw her, I was like, I think this is a secondary mitochondrial disorder because of just how she presented. So we treated it that way and still do. We just now know exactly, you know, what the gene hit is, but we still don't totally understand what the gene does. And that is what one of the teams at Baylor is looking into. Because if we understand exactly what's wrong with the energy metabolism, that might help us treat it better. But like the Wiley said, a lot of these rare gene mutations are like, it's hard to cure someone's genes yet, right? There's like lots of cool and sci-fi about editing genes. And potentially that's in our new future.
It's growing.
We hear about CRISPR. We're certainly doing that in some animal models and doing some clinical trials for gene editing.
We're getting close. Rare disease.
Exactly.
For sure. A lot of it is around,
For sure. And yeah, exactly. And actually the metabolic disorders and the mitochondrial disorders are potentially a good target for that because, if we're fixing the energy metabolism, like the rest of the body isn't, won't continue to deteriorate if we can kind of fix that one break in the energy metabolism. So there are other kind of categories of disease in where there's blocks in some part of the metabolism that are potentially good candidates for gene editing in the future, near or distant future. So So I think I answered your question in a very long-winded way. And potentially with lots of medical terms, but hopefully that made sense.
Yes, absolutely. So my last question is for the two of you as parents. Obviously, you have been full-time parents, since your first child was born, but now you're full-time caregivers as well. And it sounds like you you already were full-time caregivers with your first daughter. Is that right?
Yes.
And now you have now you've got two daughters who need a lot of attention and need a lot of care, So I was just wondering if there's anything in particular, like how are you handling the impact that this has had on your life, and how are you guys coping with it? How, like, what ways has it changed your life, and how has it surprised you?
That's a hard question.
Sorry.
I guess in a short version, we've just changed our way of thinking. We've always been very anxious planning people, and this has just taught us to take it day by day. Maybe sometimes minute by minute, second by second. When we were in the hospital, when both of our girls were in the hospital at the same time, we were finally under one roof again when Adelaide got transferred to downtown. So both of our girls were in downtown Children's, and it was just kind of like, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do this with both of our girls in the hospital? At this point, Adelaide wasn't being treated for Kawasaki disease yet, which that's a whole nother thing. Aislinn didn't have the diagnosis yet because we were still waiting on the exome sequencing. So in that moment, I think we just kind of changed our way of thinking. We just need to take it little by little, second by second, day by day. And then, we've just kind of learned to just appreciate each day that we have with our kids. I definitely was not as grateful and thankful for our life we had before this, but we're really grateful for even having both of our kids being able to be home with us. We're all under the same roof in our own house, not in a hospital.
Yeah. So they're both home right now? Sorry.
Yes, they're both home.
That's good to know. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Aislinn has a fighting chance, you know.
We're still not sure of
what recovery is going to be.
Her life expectancy, we don't know any of that. Yeah. There's so much not known about this disease, but we're just taking it day by day.
Well, that's really admirable. I think, you know, there's a lot going on, but, you know, there's also a lot of new discovery in this too. You know, like, she is part of something bigger. She's helping everyone else who has this, or anyone who will ever experience this, you know, like, she's...
That's what we keep telling ourselves too.
Yeah.
You know, Ashley keeps telling, like, you know, she's like, Aislinn's gonna help change the world, you know?
Definitely.
Like, yeah, you know, she don't even realize it, but she is going to make a difference in this world.
Thank you, Dr. Shillington, and thank you, Ashley and Jacob Wiley, for sharing Aislinn's story with us. If you'd like to support Tango 2 Research Foundation, the Wileys are asking for $1 donations from 1 million people to help progress the research for this rare disease. Next month, we'll be back with another expert to discuss a different rare disease. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss our monthly episodes. In the meantime, check out our daily coverage on rare disease and medical news at our website, hcplive.com, and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I'm your host, Juliana Grassi. Thank you for joining me on another episode of The Rare Disease Report.